Welcome to the Sum of It All Cultivating Mathematical Hearts podcast. I'm Audrey Mendeville, along with my colleagues Mark Alcorn and Kara Hetrick from the San Diego County Office of Education. And this season, we're diving into the book Cultivating Mathematical Hearts, Culturally Responsive Mathematics Teaching in Elementary Classrooms by Maria del Rosario Zavala and Julia Maria Aguirre. Transcripts to our podcast are always available for you in the episode notes on your favorite platform. This week, we're diving into Chapter 5, Power and Participation, and we are thrilled to welcome our colleague Kara Hetrick to the podcast. Kara joined our math team at the San Diego County Office of Education a few months ago, has been reading along with us this season, and is finally ready to jump into the conversation. We are so glad to have you, Kara.
Thanks, Audrey. I am super excited to be here to discuss the third strand of the culturally responsible mathematics teaching tool. These last three dimensions are ones that are really important for all of us to dive into. Mark, what did you think?
Well, Kara, our authors get us right into the important stuff right at the beginning of the chapter. Let me just jump in with a quote from page 97. Power and positionality are always at play in mathematics classrooms. Wow, Audrey, such a direct and true statement. Even if not intentional, it is happening.
Yeah, Mark, I highlighted the exact same sentence. I really appreciate the connection then that if we know that it's true, then what are we doing to, as the authors say, they quote them, support positive and productive interactions, minimize status issues and disrupt stereotypes, and invite students to take action to address inequities, and injustices within the mathematics classroom. That's the whole basis for the strand and the dimensions we're going to dive deeply into in this episode, and I'm excited to do that. So speaking of which, let's kick it into the first one. Our first dimension is called distributing intellectual authority. Mark, kick us off.
Well, you know, the authors really give us some really great reflective questions to think about regarding this distributing of intellectual authority. And one of them is, are you taking up more space than your students? I just love reflection questions like this, that I could see myself like having a few of these, like as I'm in the planning stage about to plan in the process of planning a lesson, but also like right after I finish a lesson, like thinking like, did I take up more space than my students in that lesson that I just finished? I think it's just so important for us as educators to have these type of simple reflection questions that run through each stage of the lesson planning and the implementation. Another question that it reminds me of that I have been using is, how many decisions will or did students make over the course of the lesson? I also think that type of a question gets at, how are we distributing this idea of intellectual authority?
That's a good one. You know, so I know that student engagement has been a super hot topic recently, and maybe it's always been, but certainly it's had renewed urgency and focus since the pandemic. And what the authors share is that this research on classrooms has shown that when teachers delegate intellectual authority to students, there is deeper engagement in learning. So I kind of wonder if maybe some of our low engagement problem is actually really a low student intellectual authority problem. And that's something we actually have a lot of control over, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's a really, really good point, Audrey. I appreciate how the authors also emphasize the need to pay attention to the distribution of mathematical authority over time and how that contributes to how all students can see themselves and other students as mathematical authorities within the classroom. This requires that there's a recognition of some different strategies that might be happening in the classroom, that there's some creativity of student problem-solving approaches, and as well as trying to honor some incomplete thinking. So really thinking about where students could go next, while also allowing students to express themselves in ways and in languages that are comfortable for them. And all of this has to happen while also making sure that all students recognize the value in what each person is bringing to the math classroom. These are sometimes difficult things as a teacher in that moment of teaching, but they can have really huge payoffs for students.
That's a great reminder. And I'm glad you picked that out from the text, Kara. That's super important. You know, another important reminder in that same section was just that not all the tools we use in this work use can work all the time or in every situation. And so there's a little section on equity sticks and other randomizers on page 99. And if you use those, it might be worthwhile to just read that section and think about it, because they can be problematic if your intent is to distribute intellectual authority. And so we have to really think about how we're using those different tools in different situations. And so the authors really encourage us to think about how do we expand the use of our collaborative participation structures. And I appreciate that.
Yeah, and Audrey and Kara, the interesting thing as we get onto the activity part of the chapter, and I think, Audrey, you mentioned this in one of our last episodes, that there's this section of each of these chapters that has an activity. The activity in this chapter is called Mapping Mathematical Authority. And wow, I don't know if either of you seen anything quite like this before, but I thought it was so interesting. And how the authors are sharing this way of interviewing students to see how they view their classmates in different ways, including the question, who would be your first pick to do math with? And it was just so interesting how they have the data that's collected from the students and a way to visualize it. If you take a look on page 105, if you have your book, you can see how they've created this map. And in this map, you could see how the authority is playing out with that classroom, because you can see based on the responses, who kids are choosing that they would do math with. And it allows you to reflect and say, who is emerging as a person with authority in the class? And who is not emerging as a person of authority? I just think this is a great way to collect authentic data from students and to use it to assess the dynamics of your classroom.
Yeah, Mark, I'm with you completely. I have never seen a tool like this. I've seen discourse maps, and that's where I thought they were going with it, nothing like this. And I really think this could be a really powerful tool. It's set in an elementary classroom, but I can just imagine it in a middle school or a high school classroom, asking those questions and looking at your map and starting to see who kind of are the nodes that everyone is connecting to and identifying as a math authority, and who's getting left out of this, and how do I refocus that in my classroom?
I agree. And I also really think that a tool like this can be helpful in making group choices and group decisions for where students should be working in order to really lift all the voices in the room. Mm-hmm. So the big idea of this dimension is that when intellectual authority is distributed, more voices, ideas, and actions can be leveraged for individual and collective mathematics learning. And this is such an important reminder about creating spaces where all students feel mathematically competent.
So true. Thanks for that. So on to dimension number two, disrupting status and power. Mark, I'm going to give you another chance to kick us off. What do you think?
Well, I know I've been pulling a lot of quotes in the last few episodes, but I'm just going to keep doing it, Audrey, because they just keep coming. Here's another fantastic quote. Academic status is often linked to ideas of smartness. And that's page 106. Kara and Audrey, this is so true in mathematics. The labels of my, and I'm going to put my quotes up. Our listeners can't see them, but they're there. The labels of my high students are often equated with this smart label. And I know that as educators, we don't always intend the labels to be having that degree of permanence, but it's so possible that that's essentially what we're doing. By saying high students, we're equating that with smart students. And the thing that's troublesome is this really starts very early in the grades. And the way I look at it is, we're saying our students' past performance, however measured, is being used to describe their current smartness, in quotes, and also to predict their future success. And all of this is just reinforcing this so-called ability tracking. And our authors get into this and call it out. I was so appreciative that they did. And they actually coined this term of academic apartheid that our authors are using to describe this whole phenomenon. So just so powerful and important for them to call that out.
Yeah, I appreciate the point that the hyper focus on gaps does not acknowledge the resources and system that is already in place to privilege some students and not others. And I think that's part of what they're getting at when they describe this. The quote that really stood out to me in this section was, there's a misguided focus on student intellectual abilities as measured by standardized tests, as if everything is equal when it is not by design. And, you know, like you think about that and you're like, you're right. It's not. It by design is not set to be equal. And yet then we're surprised when the outcomes are not equal. So disparities continue to be perpetuated in our system. And so I appreciate the author's push that instead of gap gazing, we need to think about taking action. And I appreciate their focus then on providing actions that and strategies we can take.
Yeah, Audrey, I also highlighted this section. It was a really great reminder that focusing on gaps instead of assets can continue to have this this effect of tracking students and creating a system in which marginalized students have reduced access to many different pathways, but they specifically call out STEM pathways, which I know is a concern of some secondary educators these days. I wonder how, if we focused on asset-based assessment systems, we could help to reduce some barriers by also increasing the mathematical confidence of our students.
Yeah, great points, Kara. I really like how you highlighted that idea of mathematical confidence of students. I think that has to be a key piece to whatever we do. And again, a familiar section in each chapter is this idea of instructional approaches. So our authors just don't talk about the what, they really give us some tools around the how. And Audrey, I just noticed just some great strategies on page 109 in this section.
Yeah, one of my favorites was the humanized assessment idea. And there's a prototype that Kara and I have both seen and experienced in different settings that's designed for secondary students. That's an asset-based assessment. But the results are really different. And so I just want to like pause and say, like, I think teachers are really, I think we all are really cultured to expect from an assessment a result that says something like, they understand 80% of it. They understand this much. These are the things they don't know. Here are the gaps, or here's the level they are at. I mean, I don't know how many times I've heard teachers say, I have these students in my ninth grade class, but they're testing at third grade math. You know, like we like to place them in these buckets, right? And when you humanize assessment and you have an assessment that is asset-based, your report comes out and it says, here's what your student knows and is able to do. And I've watched teachers just look at the data and then like, what am I supposed to do with this? Like, it's very interesting. It's very important and impactful data, but I don't know that we've been trained in our system. I don't know that we have enough training, that we've thought deeply enough about, like, now that if we shift our practice with assessment, how do we help teachers then use that data to then think about what do we do next with it? I think it could be really powerful, but I'm not sure we're quite ready to let go of our 80% gap gazing, you know, ideals. So,
yeah, good points, Audrey. I think that we always need to think with our practitioner hat on of how we as teachers can use whatever data that we have. Again, I'm going to bring forward one of the activities from this chapter, and this is for this dimension. It's called Telling New Stories on page 113 and 114. The idea of creating a math origin story and the second part of creating student strength stories. And Audrey and Kara, I just want to highlight that idea of creating student strength stories. That really resonated with me. And the authors talk about this as a deliberate intention to create a counter narrative about a particular student that would focus on a student's strengths. And I encourage everybody to go to that particular section on 114 and take a look at that, because I just think we have so many narratives that play out in our schools. And in so many cases, we need to be actively engaged in creating a counter narrative about students who have a narrative has been created for them and passed along. And it's just so important for us to have the tools to create this counter narrative.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Mark. You know, I was thinking of that in the context of the second part of that activity, which talked about creating your own origin story and thinking about how your experience shaped who you became as a teacher. And I think we, as leaders, I'm going to talk to leaders for a second here, educational leaders, make assumptions about both elementary and secondary math teachers. Like, I think there's assumptions that elementary teachers became teachers to teach reading and writing and not to be math teachers, that they're not strong in math like that. And that secondary math teachers, that their whole identity is wrapped up in being great at being at math, right? And I don't know that those are true for all people who are in those positions. And I think sometimes we have to think about how to develop the counter narrative for both of those sets of individuals in order to think about how we serve and support them in rethinking how they teach students. So I think there's maybe a parallelism there, and also a really interesting dive for each of us to do in terms of thinking about how our own perspectives develop. So I enjoyed that. But in light of time, the big idea of this dimension, as the author state, is just this deliberate, compassionate focus on student strengths. And doing so can disrupt entrenched stereotypes, power dynamics, and the things that block meaningful mathematical learning. And I appreciate that so much.
Yeah, it was a really fabulous dimension to read. We're going to move on to the very last dimension. It is analyzing and taking action. And so, Mark, we're going to start with you again.
Well, great. You know, what was interesting that I wanted to share with both of you is that I don't know if you noticed in this section, the authors pointed out that with these dimensions, there's this really cool bookend thing going on. I was like, what? That's so cool. Like, I wonder if they planned it that way. Probably. That dimension one, if you go all the way back to dimension one in strand one, that was cultural and community-based funds of knowledge. And that first dimension connects very nicely to this last dimension. And I was just thinking about, I'm so glad the authors, if they were intentional about that, that they decided to let us in on it, because I think it's just so beautiful how it works out. It's so true. If we anchor ourselves in that first dimension for our students, we will be more likely to position students to be change agents in their community, which is what we're going to talk about now.
Yeah, I love that. You know, this also reminded me a lot of our revised California math framework. There were so many pieces here that that kind of intertwine with the intent, one of the intents of the revisions, which is to really focus in on how students take action and are poised and prepared to take action using mathematics in order to do that, to disrupt inequities that they see and to think about social justice. And so I appreciate sometimes when kind of all the things you read kind of line up nicely. And I'm just seeing that in a lot of our spaces right now. And noting that for those of us in California listening in, there's a lot of overlap between the intent there of the revised framework and what's going on in this book.
Yeah, that's a good connection, Audrey, to the California Mathematics Framework, the newest draft. And you know, what comes along with that, with some of the things you're talking about, is that oftentimes as educators, we're like, I need to go find all these lessons. I need to go find all these lessons so we can do this stuff that we're supposed to do now. And that kind of like sort of quick, like as the adult, I need to figure this all out and I need to then give it to my students. What's wonderful at the top of 116 is our authors share this table of examples and they introduce it as a student-generated list of change agent actions. I just think it's so great that this list of examples are student-generated. These are topics that intersected students' lives in some way and some type of action that could be associated with that topic. I'll just read a couple of them. Donating supplies for a local pet adoption event. Beautifying our school with planting flowers. Helping families that are unhoused with a toy drive. And there's many other great examples. In addition to that table, on the next page, again, we have some more instructional approaches as our authors give us in each of these dimensions. And I don't know about the two of you, but my book, I have just like covered my page with underlining on these instructional approaches. Kara, what about you?
I absolutely did that as well, Mark. There were so many great ideas here. I was really impressed that the authors gave some great examples of ways that students could be change agents, and you highlighted a couple of them, but there's more in the instructional approaches section. And I like how the ideas were simple, but also could be impactful for communities. Sometimes when teachers think about creating projects or lessons that ask their students to be change agents, they think that it needs to be something massive, but the list that they provide are things like letter writing and presentations to school boards or city councils, or creating an infographic or a mural that could inform the community about an idea. And so this is such a great reminder that being a change agent includes making larger school or citywide movements, but it also includes making some changes that might cause an individual to reflect on their own choices. Along with that, I was also impressed with how cross-curricular some of these ideas are. And it really made me think that if you're into project-based learning or if you are a PBL school, that there's many opportunities here where students could use math to help explain an issue or clarify viewpoints, or to suggest a solution to a problem that could help engage students in civil action connected to social, environmental, or even political issues, just to name a few.
Yeah, those are great things to pull out from this section. I really appreciate that. I think the quote that's going to stick with me that I highlighted, but I also wrote it on a post-it note, kind of just living on my desk right now, is that students are both witnesses and actors in our world. And I appreciate that reminder. I think we've talked about it before in other seasons and other episodes, and other pot, you know, books that like our children are part of the real world now in the classroom. They're experiencing it, but they're also seeing it, right? They're both in it and watching it. And so how do we think about our lesson design in light of that information? So with that, the big idea of this dimension is that our students can be change agents with mathematics, that they can make the positive impact for themselves, for their friends, their families, their community, and for the world around them. I love that.
I agree completely. And I just want to say to you both, like this chapter was so great. And just one thing I just want to say again that I'm walking away with is this connection between that first dimension and that last dimension about centering cultural and community and connecting that to taking action. And just powerful examples from students included in the chapter. Let's center the students and remember that they are great resources of ideas. We don't have to come up with the ideas and feed them to them. And we should leave room for their brilliance, and not spending all of our time away from them, trying to develop all these contexts to try to connect to their world. But why not start with them? They're the experts on their world, and that could be great. Well, thanks for joining us for this episode. In our next episode, we will chat about chapters 6 and 7, using culturally responsive mathematics teaching in math lessons. Until then, best wishes in cultivating joy and justice in the mathematics classroom.